Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Economics Design Podcast. My name is Ari Kimmelman. I'm a research analyst here with Economics Design, and today I'm very excited to be joined by our two guests, Francis and Calvin, from the blockchain game Shrapnel. Thank you two for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Before we jump into things, could you two please introduce yourselves?
Francis, go ahead.
Sure. Francis on the head of economics at Shrapnel, and then also do some BD work as well. In terms of kind of background, formerly an aerospace engineer. So I did mainly reinforcement learning applications for drone tech, so swarms, autonomous systems, and image recognition, like kind of integrating those into them. Then I pivoted into crypto as someone who just wanted to analyze token economies from an investment perspective to see what was healthy and, you know, kind of just looking at supply and demand, trying to find good designs in the space. Found my way onto Shrapnel in January this year. And then I think in terms of background in gaming, because I feel like that's important if you're going to, you know, be on a game design team, longtime MMORPG player, kind of started playing RuneScape in 2002, moved on to World of Warcraft, and then pivoted into FPSs and MOBAs. Probably got way too many hours. I know my League of Legends and World of Warcraft hours are over 20,000 hours each. So in terms of gaming, I've got the experience. Let's put it that way.
Cool.
Very cool. So I'm Calvin Zhou, head of business development at Shrapnel. My background, I do have an economics background as well. Studied economics and financial engineering at Columbia University. Later went to the finance world in investment banking and hedge funds. That's kind of where I got my financial chops. Been a lifetime gamer as well. Started off on the early StarCraft, StarCraft 1, modding, creating custom maps. So got a whiff of, you know, UGC and all that has to offer. And yeah, it's been a pleasure, you know, sort of designing the ecosystem with Francis and nerding out over all the details.
Great. So for today's conversation, I would like to focus on the economics of Shrapnel. It's also worth mentioning that the economics design team has partnered with Shrapnel to work on the game's economy. So I anticipate we'll have a great conversation for today. Now, before we jump into things, I'll give a brief introduction about the game and its general economy design. So Shrapnel is a first-person shooter where players are tasked with finding and extracting valuable resources. The game is free to play and has a single token called Shrap. The game also includes NFTs, which can take the form of weapons, armor, and other features. There are two game modes, ranked and unranked. In ranked games, players require some form of NFT, like a gun, to participate, and that item can be stolen by other players if they are killed, also taking ownership of that NFT. For the unranked version, no NFTs are required and players can simply play for fun. The game is currently in its beta, and there's also a great economic paper that I would highly recommend our listeners to check out. There's also some great UGC potential within the game that I'm excited to discuss with you too. So with that said, I'm going to just ask if there's anything for you to add to that introduction.
Yeah, I think with the kind of comments on ranked and unranked, we're a better way to think about it is pay to play and free to play. In terms of funnels, like ranked and unranked is a good segregation for other games, because like the ranked or the paid section is very hardcore, and that's like the adrenaline's high, which is typical of most ranked game modes. And then the unranked section is our free to play section. That funnel is the largest. Those are the types of people that just enjoy casual games of, you know, Fortnite, Call of Duty, whatever it is. And then we can slowly funnel them into the paid section using various incentives that I'm assuming we'll get into later in the podcast.
Cool. Okay, good. So let's jump into the first question for today. Could you two walk us through the player experience as soon as a player loads the game, and as well as some details about the actual gameplay?
Yeah. So when a player, you know, loads into the game, they'll sign in with an email and password. We'll create a wallet in the back end if they don't have one. Very Web 2 environment. There is no blockchain like kind of pushed in front of you. There's no fees that you're paying. You simply click. You go to the free section or the unranked section and you just click play. We take you into a session and you can run around and loot gear. So the actual game loop, the way this works, is it's an FPS with RPG elements kind of placed on top of that. So if you think of an Escape from Tarkov, if you're familiar with that, if you're not, an extraction game mode is similar to a battle royale. So it's in an arena. With for us, it's between 10 to 40 players, and there is loot that is spawned in the arena, and players will also bring loot in as well. So if you find loot or you kill a player, you can actually take that and keep it, as you said. And then to get out, we have three stages. So each stage finishes with an extraction loop where you can get onto a dropship and extract anything that you've taken. And if you've managed to successfully extract, that gear then becomes something that is in your persistent inventory and you can take to the next game. The kind of thesis behind having three sections to the game is that first section, you're just trying to, you know, scout around the map. There's not going to be too much combat. It's for the players that want to sit lower on the adrenaline threshold. And then slowly as the game goes on, we'll push you into the second section of the game where it's slightly more adrenaline. Most of the people that just want to kind of leave early on because they're either looting up or they're new to the game have left. And this is your chance to kind of have some gunfights with people that have equal skill or even slightly greater. And then the final section is like the high streamable, highly intense moments. The combat is highly incentivized. The loot is worth much, much more. The players that are left are the people that are really kill hungry. And that's where the best loot is. That is the most high adrenaline part of the game. And that's where kind of the most value will also be extracted from the session too.
I just want to add to the user journey and the UI UX is that we've designed a game to where we meet the player where they kind of want to be met. If they're not used to non-custodial wallets and just want to have a traditional gaming experience, we can offer that to them, you know, through a custodial wallet solution that is kind of running in the background and you're not even aware of it. I mean, if you really think about it, Fortnite kind of has a custodial wallet as well. It's just not called that, right? So if the player also wants self-custody and to mess around with DeFi and, you know, all that, just more granular details on just sort of ownership of assets and whatnot, then we could provide that to them as well. So they just kind of want to make that clear that the user journey and the you know, sort of user experience is where just meeting the player where they want to be met.
Yeah, I'd love if you two could touch on how NFTs are incorporated into the game's economy and how their prices are determined.
Yeah, so everything in the game is an NFT other than bullets and consumables. And then the way kind of we're looking at pricing is you've got entry level gear, which we will actually try and maintain some kind of peg. So there'll be, if there's no kind of supply being sold to meet the demand, we will actually sell onto the market for people to purchase those at an affordable price. And if there is no buying demand, we will meet them kind of and purchase those off them. So there's obviously a spread there, which is profitable for us, but it also provides a consistent experience for people that want to enter and leave the platform. So any tiers above entry level, we won't be kind of maintaining the price on those. That is purely based on player speculation, but the actual values is something that we're going to make affordable. Well, we're going to ensure it's affordable, but the exact numbers aren't kind of determined yet. If you look at other comparables in terms of time to lose, you are looking at, you know, between 2 to 10 cents as kind of an entry level piece of gear. It really depends on what playtesting says and what we come out with in actual players playing the game and figuring out what they want to spend.
And the key thing here is that players deal with NFTs. They may not even have to deal with the token. The token is more or less decoupled from the player economy. So I get a lot of questions. It's people who don't understand the relationship between the token and the NFTs, to where if they just assume that if the token goes exponential in price, that it just prices people out of the game. We don't have that. The NFTs, like Francis said, are more or less, you know, trading in this sort of band of prices. It's price stabilized. And if the token goes up in price, you just sort of end up paying less tokens to acquire NFTs. So the NFTs are more or less a stable asset. The token is a way more volatile asset.
Mm-hmm. And keeping the prices within this range, is there any economic concerns regarding how the levers are manipulated there that are important for people to be aware of, or from an economics perspective?
Yeah, there's quite a lot. So one thing we have to be aware of is kind of how much we've got in reserve to purchase back the gear to make sure it is a sustainable environment. But one advantage we have in the game is it's naturally deflationary. So because of the way extraction duties work, like if you look at Tarkov, I think around 20% of the loot taken in is actually taken out. So a lot of people lose a lot of things all the time. So it's more so that we're going to have to be giving people free things. So fortunately, with the design of the game, the token would have to crash to an extreme proportion for us to be in any way affected by kind of a slip in token price to then affect the reserves of our ability to support the ecosystem. But yeah, the kind of the gears and the flows and levers of the gear, where we can bring it into the ecosystem through gifts, you can take it out through gameplay, we can take it out through crafting. There's tons of kind of unique incentives that we can give to players to hold on to things. And then we also have the concept of trade restrictions. So if we're noticing that the economy needs a little less sell pressure, we can actually incentivize people to play with trade restricted gear. And maybe we've given them something for free and we say, hey, if you can play five loops with game loops with this, we'll untrade restrict it for you. And taking people away from the incentive of playing with something that they can sell and moving it on to, hey, this there's something you can do over here for your character progression. And that's actually going to help you build within the game itself. So there's tons of like psychological things we can do to move people out of the marketplace, as well as not manipulate, but like control the supply in an effective manner to ensure that the gear is stable.
Yeah, I think that's a very unique characteristic of a game economy designer, game economist, is you literally have the ability to maneuver these rules, which in turn change players' behaviors and how they act in terms within the ecosystem or within the game, for example. So I want to ask a question about the Shrap token. So I want to know why the team elected to use a cryptocurrency within the game as opposed to a hard currency seen in Web2 games.
Yeah, there's quite a few affordances that gives us in terms of the actual blockchain itself. Having it on a distributed ledger, Calvin loves data persistence and data availability. It is something which means that if you create something using the token, it will exist forever as an NFT. So if you're making user-generated content within our game, that will exist on a blockchain, that will exist on decentralized storage. And therefore, at any point, even if Shrapnel didn't exist, you are guaranteed that what you've made can potentially be used elsewhere as well in the future. So if we have future integrations with other games, or you just want to see your creation itself, you can do that because it is an NFT. Because of the way blockchains work, they need an underlying currency, and therefore we have Shrap. It is also kind of very useful in terms of if we do partner with other Web3 games, you can leave our ecosystem and liquidate your assets much easier and transfer those elsewhere in a much better way than, say you if you went into your Steam balance and then Steam has to get a ton of licenses so that you can take that into your bank and you can put that into another game. No, for us, you just sell, you leave the ecosystem, and then you go into another game. So it adds a lot to retention as the gaming ecosystem grows. It means players can move between games in a much less parasitic way for the industry. So it has a ton of benefits for us in the back end, and I'm sure Calvin's got some more probably.
Yeah. I think a really interesting sort of philosophical issue with a lot of token designs is, I've heard some folks say, we don't even need a token. Why even have a token, right? You can just use USDC, or you can just have an economy built on NFTs. And I think for us, just having a token defines sovereignty. It defines the rules of engagement within, a particular network. And that's really what tokens are kind of used for. If you think about it, in the real world, there's plenty of tokens that exist. They're called currencies. And a currency defines a border, it defines a culture, it defines a network of folks choosing to live by a certain standard, a certain rule. You could certainly use someone else's currency in your country, but I've yet to see successful examples of that. Usually people do that because their own currency has collapsed, right? And so first and foremost, we believe we are, sort of not only defining building a game, but building an ecosystem, a metaverse, slowly evolving into a metaverse, if you will, with its own set of rules, own sovereignty, own social and cultural value. Therefore, a token is warranted. Also, you know, peer-to-peer networks, there's an argument to be made that peer-to-peer network, you don't have to even use a cryptocurrency for payments for peer-to-peer, right? I could just pay you in gold bars, or I can wire, I can Venmo you. Like if I'm, you know, using the network, why even pay gas fees? I can literally just Venmo validators for their computing power and storage, right? There's already said that, you know, if all the constituents of the network are owned and have stake and are involved in the currency, that's the way to solve the cold start problem. And so if there is a currency and you've created it within your ecosystem, then everyone, including the players, the validators, everyone involved in that ecosystem has a direct incentive to promote and to grow the network. And that's a really good use case of just even having a unique token. And yeah, I think those two are kind of hopefully solves the problem of, you know, why token.
And I think from a game design, so if we take a step back and just look at it from a game design perspective, you know, you take a look at Eve, RuneScape, World of Warcraft, they all have in-game currencies that you can actually very simply transfer to being US dollars. It's not very simple, but it's simple enough to where you know a conversion rate and you can look at your bank balance and kind of figure it out. But the idea of having them is you obfuscate the thought of, okay, my time is worth N amount of dollars or X amount of dollars, and I can play the game and make, you know, $2 an hour, for example. The whole purpose of the currency is it absorbs you into that kind of world that Calvin's talking about, where you're just thinking about the game and not about the money that you're making. So it really helps extract the thought process of, okay, I'm here to make money. And it keeps the gamers thinking, okay, I've just got some strap. What can I spend it on within the game that I'm playing? Obviously, there are some people that will think from a more financial aspect, and we do have kind of areas of the game that we can send them, but it does really help gamers not go, okay, I just spent 10 US dollars on the skin. No, because that's why every game, like, you know, you look at Fortnite, you look at Roblox, you don't put US dollars onto it. You buy a digital currency first, and then it makes it easier for you to spend because it absorbs you into the ecosystem as opposed to having you think about money first.
Yeah, for sure. And ultimately, we want Trapp to have a monetary premium, right? To where potentially other currencies and other assets are backed by Trapp. So that's kind of the end game.
Interesting. So I want to ask about one of the utilities of the Trapp token. So the NFTs are priced in US dollars. And then the Trapp token, it's used as like an intermediary between USD and the actual NFT, if I'm correct. So I'm wondering if you could explain why this decision was made and why that's beneficial to like the Trapp token's value.
Yeah, so the prices of things will be kind of soft set in a USD price range, just so that you don't have to deal with that massive, you know, if there is a change in Trapp's price, whether it's up or down, no player has to think, oh, my account value has taken X or Y hit. And that's part of the obfuscating the finances from them. So I think that that's kind of the thought process of why it's in USD, but you purchase with Trapp, because Trapp is the thing we're using to keep like have them think that they're in the Shrapnel ecosystem. But you know, your local currency is kind of what you want your assets to stay valued in, depending on your currency, of course. And that helps us keep a stable economy in terms of what people are spending. Because if Trapp, you know, doubles in price, you know, one week, when we're looking at monetization metrics, it can be very difficult if things aren't all in USD, which is what people locally think in, and everything's in Trapp, which is now twice as valuable. It can make it difficult to analyze what is a healthy economy and what isn't.
Yeah, and I would argue it's not just Trapp. Most a lot of assets in cryptocurrency, the unit of account is the US dollars. And I would even argue that it's not just reserved for cryptocurrency. It's a lot of assets, given that, you know, the US dollar is the sort of global reserve currency. You know, even stocks, I don't count my Tesla shares as X number of shares. I count it in terms of US dollars. And so it's really that just that unit of account that also reflects in a lot of cryptocurrencies. Like, we, you know, I tend to count in Ethereum, not in terms of how many ETH I have, but you know, what's the US dollar equivalent of that per ETH. So yeah,
interesting. So I want to move on to the topic of generating revenue for the project. So I'm wondering, what are the main revenue streams for the treasury?
Yeah, so that's players kind of buying gear when there isn't a demand, because that goes into the market making fund. And then once that gear is burned, that can go to the treasury because we no longer need to support that asset. There's the concept of paying mint fees. So when, you know, someone comes in, creates a map or creates a skin, obviously we handle all the back-end storage and take some profit from that mint fee. So that also builds up the treasury. Then there is secondary kind of marketplace fees as well. So as people trade their weapons, as people trade on the marketplace for content as well, we do take a cut, and that also accrues to the treasury. So they're kind of the three main sources of revenue for the treasury itself.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
So from an economics perspective, one of the elements within the Shrap economy is the fact that these games are zero sum, right? So it's not, you know, assets aren't being minted out of nowhere, so to speak. So I'm wondering if you could share a little bit more about why this design decision was made within the game.
Yeah, so it kind of ties back to controlling and making a consistent environment for players. If your game is either zero sum at best or deflationary, that means we can actually give people, you know, a surplus in gifts, or we can do incentive programs and then kind of make up that net, that delta, to make it net neutral. But if your game is inflationary, we can't promise a consistent environment because the game is consistently inflationary, and we would then have to be buying back assets all the time that we can't necessarily afford. So the key is, if we make it zero sum or deflationary, we have a lot of tools that we can use, such as gifts. It is a lot easier for us to give you things for free that have value in the ecosystem itself than take away things that have value from you to control inflation. So that's kind of the thesis, is it's easier for us to control a deflationary system and pump things in because it's digital assets that we can create as needed, as opposed to, you know, take from your inventory and say that's not yours anymore because the economy would be unsustainable.
Yeah. Also a ecosystem where you're constantly sort of playing for emissions tokens forces players to keep on playing perpetually to maintain their pro rata share of their asset stake. And we you know, from a philosophical standpoint, that may not be the best way to, you know, maintain an ecosystem, is to force, you know, like participation to maintain pro rata. So that's just another thing to kind of think about. And those, you know, emissions based gameplay or game economies, so far, we, from what we've seen, may not do so hot, mostly because you also have sort of players, or you know, people who don't want to stay in the ecosystem and effectively farm and mine those emissions tokens and then leave by selling, so quote unquote earning. So that you know, presents a constant sell pressure on you know, on that token as well, and you know, there some players are just kind of in it for financial motives, and we believe the best way to maintain an ecosystem is for them to stay in the ecosystem and enjoy it and want to live there, or you know, spend a lot of time there and socialize, and zero sum ends up doing a lot better than mining or competing for emissions tokens.
Mm-hmm. An interesting idea that I've discussed with some other teams is that when game economy designers or game economists have the opportunity to, you know, increase the amount of resources or increase the number of NFTs or change the price, I think this can be an interesting conversation, as the number of transactions and the overall proportion of money going into these games and are circulating within these games increases, because potentially what we're seeing is hundreds of millions of dollars circulating in assets, whether they're virtual assets, whether the currency within the game. And so it creates a question of, I would say, politics and regulation, because in most senses, you are responsible for creating the rules to the best of your abilities, but there's not necessarily a guarantee. It, you know, could go one way or the other. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are in terms of really the power this position has to make a successful game, and additionally to really make or break a very large economy.
I think because we're built on the pillar of consistency, like we want to provide a stable experience for everyone, and that is how we're designing everything. Keeping your net kind of asset values equal or somewhat equal. So say we make a change to the game, and the gun that you were using is now half as valuable, for example, we will offer some type of reparations, whether it's swapping to another weapon or, you know, something, a trade in value. So that there is the concept that, yes, we may change things in the ecosystem, which, you know, could, I guess, be seen as a political move in this aspect or in this analogy. But what we're going to try and do is make sure that the people are either made whole or maintained their balance sheet. So no one is going to lose because we decided to make a change for balance reasons or for retention reasons. People will maintain kind of what they've.
Yeah, the way I like to think about it we're the benevolent governor of, you know, the platform, to, you know, also the inventor of the ecosystem, to sort of ensure that it gets to this sort of long run equilibrium stability. In the meantime, there's obviously a lot of rules and regulations set in place to ensure that everyone gets to the promised land, right? But, you know, sort of after the promised land is achieved, we can all pat ourselves on the back and sort of have a more laissez-faire style governance structure. Another sort of interesting thing is kind of on, you know, voting and token voting and DAOs and whatnot. I've studied this quite a bit, but the sort of TLDR version is, one token, one vote. It's interesting, but a lot of people don't vote. So how do you sort of incentivize people to vote and participate? There's also sort of delegated voting techniques, but ultimately we want the platform to be governed by its, you know, sort of stakeholders and also maxing out participation and have a true sort of, you know, quote unquote, true democracy in that sense. I'm just rambling here, but just keep in mind that, you know, stability of networks comes at a cost, and usually that cost is centralization initially to make sure that people and that the network properly thrives. So
yeah, I think Calvin's point on centralization is a key, like maintaining a stable game economy, especially with a consistently changing meta, because, you know, players are responsible for the UGC, does require some level of oversight from people that are familiar with the economy and know what levers to push and pull. It's not something where you could just let a community decide to do it, because the incentives or the short-term incentives might eventually outweigh the long-term incentives to keep a stable economy, and someone might make certain decisions to extract capital. But as someone working on the game economy, our long-term incentive, or our incentive, is to make it long-term sustainable. So even though it is a partially centralized system, the whole point is we build up trust and we stay transparent. And therefore, you know that we're trying to make the best decisions for the game itself. And I think that incentive alignment is key to maintaining the sustainable economy itself.
I agree. I'd say it's a little bit of a tricky situation, right? Because you want to empower players, but to the same degree, they could easily, you know, manipulate the economy to make what their, you know, their own assets more valuable than they should be, or act not in the best interest of the group. And so this is an interesting idea I've been tackling in my head, which is trying to justify or rationalize whether the presence of DAOs within games, let's say the transition from a centralized authority to a decentralized authority, is actually beneficial to the overall game, because there's a lot of potential drawbacks that come from players voting on games and people manipulating the game, as opposed to simply a team that's developing a game that's already dedicated towards the game's success, right? The incentives there, people know why they're developing the game. The same can't be said by the people who are voting and making these decisions.
Yeah, I think there's a game called Old School RuneScape that has a very good kind of mentality towards this. Like, the community take part in initial proposals. They, as game designers, then go and vet those proposals to see, you know, does this break anything? Is this going to be too overpowered? Then there's a vote by players. So, and depending on kind of what type of player you are, you might get to vote if it affects you. You might not if it doesn't affect you. And they need 75% yes to pass that vote. And those types of systems work where it's a collaboration between the two, where there's a proposal, we vet that proposal, then the players vote on what we say is the way that we can implement that.
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it centralization. I would call it a series of rules and constraints that people can rely on. For example, if the physics of the world changed all the time, and you know, due to some DAO governance structure up in the universe of controllers or inventors, this world wouldn't be a very fun world to live in, right? We kind of need to be guided by certain constraints and rule sets that come from quote unquote a centralized authority to establish that sort of permanence of structure.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on to the topic of NFTs. I know we talked about NFTs a little bit previously, but I'm wondering, because there's a lot of flow between games, I'm wondering what incentives are held within the game to encourage people to reinvest within the game and hold on to their assets.
Yeah, I think that's something we do through the game team itself, as opposed to the economic side. So it's about, because as a game, it is an RPG style game. So there is character progression. There is like tiers between the guns that you're trying to progress through. So it's about abstracting kind of that thought of US dollars and how much money I'm making, and more saying, okay, I'm building my character to play this ranked mode that I really enjoy, or have this particular play style. So it's about obfuscating the thought of finances from the game and turning it into, okay, this is just an RPG game that I'm trying to progress through, similar to, Skyrim, World of Warcraft, whatever it is. And I think that's kind of the way we go about it, as opposed to treating it like a financial system. Get the game right first, so that players are playing a game and trying to progress through a game, and then work on the economy afterwards, depending on what people seem to be attracted to in terms of progressing.
Yeah. Yeah. Financials are certainly a part of it, but if it's, if the reason why you're staying in the ecosystem is because you're gonna, you're dreaming of making lots of money, those structures are pretty unstable. Eventually they collapse, and then you have no other incentive to stay in the ecosystem, so you leave. We want to create an ecosystem with deep and rich lore, with social, with people staying, not because they want to max out earnings, but because they're willing to trade off some of that earnings with sort of more intangible benefits, such as, their friends are here, or, they just really enjoy the lore or the gameplay experience and whatnot. And quite frankly, that's how any, network or any new thing gets formed. Like if you, discover a new island somewhere and decide to settle down there, bring your assets over there, you can't just be in it because you're in it for gold or some new resource on the island. You're in it because your friends are there. You have children there. You keep your assets there and you reinvest it. You want to grow the island. You want it to become the hot spot, the new place where everyone else is. So that's, you have a very, we want to design an ecosystem where you have an incentive to stay, because you're a stakeholder and you want to grow the ecosystem from a non-financial perspective.
So one of my favorite things about the Shrapnel game is its emphasis on UGC. So could either of you two please give a little bit of information in terms of how building maps and building buildings work, and additionally, how that relates to players staking their tokens?
Yeah, so in terms of kind of the creation process, you'll use tools specially made by us, which we will also be using, just to show that you can make professional level quality from them, and they'll range in kind of difficulty there. So as you use the tools more and become more experienced, or have shown to us that you are an experienced developer, we can just give you access to the high level tools. And what that does is everyone has a kind of stepping stone to get on, which is an appropriate difficulty for them to start building, so that we can start seeding kind of high level content. It should be as simple as applying Instagram filters to your phone, depending on what you're doing. So if you are just making a map, you can go to the marketplace and you can place objects from the marketplace onto your map, and manipulate them as you wish. So you can think paintbrush style, drag and drop style, very, very easy tools. We want anyone to be able to kind of do this so that the thing itself will be very, very low level, very simple complexity at the baseline, all the way to full access to the engine, depending on how much we, you know, trust you as a player, which will be through our reputation system. Then the way kind of content governance works, which is the staking that you were talking about, is one thing we want to do is we want to find good content in a sea of just general content. And there's no way for us to figure out if something is, I mean, there is ways to find malicious content, but finding what is objectively good to a player requires player opinion. And one of the ways to do that is to financially incentivize them by giving them a potential to stake behind as an opinion. So if you look at Google's algorithm, they have, you know, backlinks and they have general popularity. You can consider staking behind it like a backlink from Forbes saying, you know, referring to your website, something that's worth some value in the opinion of the rankings. And that's kind of how we treat the staking. So if you give your opinion, we can then financially rewards you based on the success. And the earlier you give your opinion, the more rewards that you would get. So if you're the second person to stake or the first person to stake, you'll be rewarded proportionally based on how much you staked and when you actually staked, because that helps us find those initial seedings of rankings. But then if you're the last person to stake, it's already the most popular map. 80% of everyone on the platform is playing it. That opinion's great, but it doesn't mean much to us because we already knew it was a popular map. And you get rewarded based off the success of the content itself. So both map creators and stakers will receive some reward. So if it's got 50% of the activity, there'll be 50% of the rewards pool split between stakers and the people that were involved in the creation process.
Yeah, and just a bit more detail on why we're doing all this. So we need to find a proper way to financially incentivize labor in content creation, right? And we don't exactly just have a slush fund of USDC laying around or stablecoins laying around to give people. So this is actually a good reason why to even have your own token is to solve the cold start problem again. How do we incentivize content creation without having a lot of money to start with? Well, you have a token, you hand them out to folks who produce great content. They play a, you know, sort of quote unquote metagame where they're, you know, mining for emissions tokens essentially. And, you know, the better content creators sort of quote unquote mine more of the emissions pool. And so that way they acquire these tokens that also make them sort of financially align with the ecosystem growth.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see how that takes place. And it's my favorite feature by far. Two more questions here before we wrap up. I'm wondering if you two could share a little bit of information regarding, firstly, what's next for the project? And secondly, why you two believe that Web3 games and blockchain technology overall improves the gameplay experience?
Yeah, so I'll answer the second one first, and I'll let Calvin take a stab at the first one. With my opinion on the second part is, I think one thing that's missing from games is if a player has $60 of capital, right now, you know, you either buy Call of Duty or Battlefield, for example. Whereas what you can do in Web3 is you can move your money and assets between games, and there's an ecosystem that you can explore. So it's amazing for retention. If you think about it by saying like, hey, you know, 1 week you'll play Shrapnel and then we might notice that you're churning and then we can send you over to another game and they can send you back because you have that mobility of capital. And it's actually long-term beneficial for both parties to keep doing that because you can reduce and limit the churn that is going on. So I kind of my thesis on why blockchain games will be so great is because you can create these ecosystems that aren't just dependent on kind of, you know, Ubisoft or Microsoft's IP. It can be across all of them. And the instead of being a model where, you know, you pay $60 to play a game, you can just have $60 of capital parked on a game that you can then move over. So I think that's kind of going to be the big thing that moves blockchain games forward. Is that ability to move between games and that shared kind of thesis that everyone has.
Yeah, and for me, I'm going to go back to the data persistence story because I really think that's the core thesis of you know, blockchain technology. So if we take an example of you know, the world we live in today, we're already used to, you know, sort of this game being persistent, right? I woke up breathing, you know, I'm sitting in front of a computer, this data is there, it's, I know it's going to be there 5 minutes from now, and probably 5 hours from now, or else I'd be freaking out and trying to figure out what else to do instead of being on this podcast, right? There's not some boogeyman in the sky who's just constantly changing data around and taking things away from you and whatnot. So this is already something we're very much used to. And especially if you buy into the simulation argument that if we're living in a simulation, then this better be a persistent simulation, right? And so what blockchains offer that traditional sort of Web2 games don't offer is that confidence of data and compute persistence. If we all migrate over to a database and a distributed computing network where not only your data is, you know, more or less persistent and secured by cryptographic guarantees, and that anyone with their resources can kind of contribute their resources in a peer-to-peer manner to secure this network, then you have more or less guarantees that there's not going to be this boogeyman in the sky who can, you know, sort of make things disappear on you. And this is no different from what we're already used to in the, you know, in this, you know, real world scenario. So I could see how potentially people would be very interested in this, you know, in the Web3 gaming space.
Cool. And last question, what's next for the project?
Yeah, so we have, you know, if you own an operator, there'll be some kind of early access things coming very soon. I guess a full look at the game is probably what's next. You know, the early alpha stages and early beta stages being looked at by the community, as well as access to various early on tools and marketplace kind of sneak peeks, where you'll be able to take early look at the kind of the way we're looking at creator tools and things you can do within the game itself.
Yeah, what I can tell you is you know, we've got a multiplayer map up that we're essentially internally playtesting every day to debug and to, you know, make sure that this building is spaced out enough with this building to make sure that, you know, like the number of players support the dimensions of the map and whatnot. So we are definitely making ways in terms of development, and next year should be a pretty big year for us.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you two for joining me on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been great.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
All right, thanks everyone.
Cheers.